You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On December 14, 2012, Adam Lanza killed his mother, then 20 children and 6 adults at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, and finally himself, one of the worst school massacres in history. In the March 17th issue of The New Yorker, Andrew Solomon, whose beat includes politics, culture, and psychology, writes that Adam Lanza was a terrorist for an unknowable cause. Two of his acts are explicable, the third incomprehensible. Mr. Solomon spoke at great length with Adam Lanza's father, Peter, and with parents of other children who have done the inexplicable. His piece is called The Reckoning, The Father of the Sandy Hook Killer Searches for Answers, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Andrew Solomon back to our show. Welcome back.
What a pleasure to be here.
Do you think Adam Lanza thought of himself as a terrorist?
It's very difficult to know what Adam's inner life was like. I feel I got to know Peter, and I got to know Nancy. Through Peter and through the emails. Adam himself emerges as removed and distant and peculiar and miserable. I have a sense of how much pain he was in and how much agony he was in. I don't know whether he would have used the word terrorist for himself, but I know that he wanted to project that internal misery onto other people. That's clear from his writings and postings.
And do we have any sense of what led to that sense of misery?
Well, he had, starting in early childhood, a sensory integration disorder. He was then diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, but he had a sense of himself as being incapable in the world. He would get overwhelmed by the idea of going out. He was supposed to go and see a tutor once for school, and he got so upset that he couldn't stop crying for 4 hours, and they couldn't take him to the tutor. He would say to his mother, "Why am I such a loser, and can't I do anything about it?" He had unbelievably low self-esteem. He was unbelievably upset by his disabilities and challenges.
If his murder of his mother, Nancy Lanza, and his suicide are explicable, what do you think is the most plausible explanation?
Well, I mean, I think he killed himself because he was someone who was clearly in acute misery. His mother's emails describe over and over and over, you know, in almost monotonous regularity. You know, today Adam was on the floor of his bathroom crying for 4 hours and he wouldn't speak all day. Today Adam was in his room weeping and I couldn't get the door open and he wouldn't tell me what was going on. I mean, it goes on and on like that.
So yeah, but people commit suicide. They don't necessarily take a whole bunch of people with them, including their mother.
No, I thought you were asking for the explanation for his suicide and his matricide. So his suicide, I think, is fairly straightforward. Matricide is a crime that's most often committed by sons who feel that they're being dominated by overbearing mothers and who want to establish some kind of freedom. And it's also clear in looking at the material that Adam felt that he was getting to be old enough so that he should be independent and able to function on his own. And he was, in fact, totally dependent on his mother for absolutely everything. And I think he experienced that as a humiliation and was full of rage and anger about it. So those are the two relatively explicable crimes. The murder of 20 children he'd never met before, as well as 6 adults, is completely inexplicable and incomprehensible.
Do you think that people who lash out at children with whom they have little or no connection seek to do the thing that they know will most horrify people?
Yes. I think Adam believed that he was hateful. He believed that his life was without value, and he wanted to make that true. He wanted to become as horrible as he understood himself to be.
And that means killing children.
Well, I mean, that seems for him to have been what it meant.
You refer to a terrible privacy. What do you mean by that?
When I set out to do this, I thought that by the time I heard everything there was from Peter and from Nancy and looked at Adam's medical records, that I would see the signposts and the red flags. But I think Adam was actually someone who, though he expressed a lot of misery and a lot of sense of dissociation from normal social structures, never appeared to be dangerous or harmful in any way. And he nurtured these terrible fantasies, which ultimately became a horrific reality. He nurtured them without it being visible to his parents. I think children have more privacy than we tend to think. And while we like to think we know our children well, we know from our own experience that our parents didn't know everything about us, and we don't know everything about our children. And the privacy of a mind can allow terrible things to happen without their being visible.
Well, when something like this happens, we immediately start looking for explanations. Is there a difference between explanation and understanding?
I think there's an enormous difference, because I think there is no such thing as an explanation for this. I mean, even if we had found out that Adam was schizophrenic or that Adam had been sexually abused as a child or something else like that, that still wouldn't explain why anyone would go and kill 20 children he'd never met before. There just is no explanation for that. So I think that's impossible. Understanding it involves recognizing all of what happened and seeing the sort of decay, the psychic decay that he was going through, but I don't think it explains it.
We usually hope that the kind of coverage a horrible story like Sandy Hook receives will help to prevent similar things from happening, but aren't there often copycat attempts afterward?
There are often copycat attempts, and the copycat attempts are something that one has to be aware of. Adam Lanza was influenced by Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris and what they had done at Columbine, which I wrote about in Far From the Tree, my last book. All of the people who commit these crimes are influenced by the other people who commit them. At the same time, talking about them and understanding them frequently gives parents the insight to take action with their own children, and it frequently gives law enforcement authorities a sense of what they need to do to prevent another episode like this. So talking about it is a double-edged sword, and I think it depends in large part on how one talks about it. I think glamorizing it is always a mistake, but I think attempting to understand it is almost always useful.
Well, but we weren't glamorizing what happened in any of those incidents, were we? Whether it was Dylan Klebold or Adam Lanza.
Some of the media essentially, I mean, none of it was approving, but some of it made it sound like they were these dramatic people who had done something extraordinary and unbelievable. It's surprising if you read the full range of what's out there. There's quite a lot of stuff that somehow seems to be all about the crime and that goes on endlessly about gory details of it in a way that isn't relevant to trying to make a better world.
I'm talking with Andrew Solomon, whose article, The Reckoning, the Father of the Sandy Hook Killer Searches for Answers, is in the March 17th issue of The New Yorker. Well, as you wrote that book on Dylan Klebold, Far From the Tree, do you see any real similarities between Adam Lanza and Dylan Klebold?
The most striking difference between them is that Dylan Klebold appeared to be a well-adjusted, functional, ordinary person getting through high school just fine, and he hid this darkness under a surface of complete normality. Adam Lanza had sensory integration disorder, Asperger's syndrome, which would now be called autism, possibly obsessive-compulsive disorder. He had all kinds of diagnoses floating around, and everyone knew that he was weird. What nobody knew was that he was dangerous. So Dylan Klebold kept his secret under a facade of normality, and Adam Lanza kept his under a facade of abnormality that didn't include what turned out to be the crucial and central abnormality. They were both hiding, but they were hiding in different ways.
Well, what did Adam Lanza's parents think should be done about the fact that you say he was weird? Although the things that you mentioned for Asperger's, for example, is often associated with OCD. Maybe they're on the same spectrum. Maybe they just present themselves in similar ways.
I think one of the central problems for the Lanzas was that Adam did have these diagnoses. We tend to think that diagnoses are a fantastic help, and they allow you to figure out how to treat your child and what the prognosis is. And people who can't get a diagnosis for children with special needs are often very frustrated by that. The danger of diagnoses is that they often seem to explain everything. So when Adam acted peculiar, or when Adam was socially withdrawn, or when Adam stayed in the basement all day, they thought, well, it's part of his Asperger's, it's part of his OCD, it's part of these conditions that we know about. And nobody thought, perhaps these are manifestations of something much more troubling and much more profound. Nobody looked at the possibility that he was becoming a psychopath, because they were preoccupied with the fact that he was suffering from these other known diagnoses.
So is that typical of parents, how parents respond to children who present difficulties? It also would suggest a certain amount of denial. You want to believe that the kid isn't as bad as it might appear, and also that everything can be fixed, everything can be corrected in the end.
Yes, I think parents do want to believe that everything can be fixed and corrected. But I also think that I think even doctors can be distracted by the diagnoses that apply, especially in a case like Adams. I mean, he did have those difficulties. It's not as though he didn't have autism or as though they just identified the wrong thing. But in identifying part of what's wrong, you don't identify all of what's wrong. And if you think you know the problem with your child, you should always remember that what you know is a problem with your child.
There have been other attacks on children by far older individuals, like the Bath School disaster in 1927, when 38 children were killed by a 55-year-old man named Andrew Kehoe. Is it different when the killers are children or when they're adults? In the end, the victims all wind up being children.
Well, I mean, I think the murder of children is really the most gruesome and terrible crime that there is and that we know about. You know, there are descriptions even in ancient Greek texts about how the final humiliation visited on the victims of attacks was the murder of children in their schoolroom.
And then Medea, of course, is a tragedy where a mother kills her children.
Yes, absolutely. But in any case, I think there frequently are people who, if they really want to horrify the world to the absolute maximum, they choose to target children. You know, the cruelty of it is so inconceivable. The idea of those parents who drop their children off in the morning and never saw them again is so unimaginable. And as for the age of the person who does it, you know, I think it's marginally different if the person who's doing it is really a little child. If Adam had been himself 8 years old and he murdered a lot of six-year-olds, it would be a slightly different news story. But effectively, anyone who murders children has committed the most grotesque transgression, and the age of the person or the other details of the person are irrelevant to the horror of the crime.
Now, it should be emphasized that your article is more about the father, Peter, than the son, Adam. And we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll talk about what you learned from talking to Adam's father, Peter, and also from the emails that you read from his mother. My guest is Andrew Solomon, whose article, The Reckoning, the Father of the Sandy Hook Killer Searches for Answers, is in the March 17th issue of The New Yorker. Stay with us for more. We're back with Andrew Solomon, whose latest article in The New Yorker is The Reckoning, the Father of the Sandy Hook Killer Searches for Answers. It is in the March 17th issue of the magazine. And I was wondering what moved Peter Lanza to want to talk to you about his son. Did you approach him or did he approach you?
He approached me. In my last book, Far From the Tree, I had written about the parents of Dylan Klebold and what their experience had been of having a son who committed a mass murder. And he felt that I had written about them fairly and justly, and he felt that I would be able to hear his story with an open mind. And so he got in touch with me and he said, "People have been asking me to tell my story all this time. I haven't felt ready to do so, but I feel ready to do so now, and I'd like to tell it to you."
How much time did you wind up spending with him?
We did six recorded interviews, which were up at his house. I think the shortest one was 3 or 4 hours, and the longest one was 7 hours. We also had a lot of phone calls, a lot of email. We had one lunch without a tape recorder at the beginning when we were just getting to know each other. So quite a lot of time over a period of 4 months.
You open your essay with a description of what Peter Lanza calls the stuff. What's the stuff?
After the massacre happened, people mailed things to Peter, to also, of course, to the families of victims, but to Peter Lanza and to Ryan Lanza, Adam's brother. And the amount of that material is absolutely staggering. I went up to the attic room where he keeps it with him, and there were crates and crates and crates. There were letters. There were stories with titles like My First Christmas in Heaven. There were boxes of candy. There were teddy bears. There were there was a cross that had been made by inmates in a death row prison. There was just an extraordinary range of stuff. most of it actually, to my surprise, supportive and positive. Most of it saying, I can imagine the pain you're in, and I'm so sorry for all that you're going through.
Well, Peter won't touch the candy that he's been sent. Does he have to worry about his safety or his older son Ryan's safety?
Well, he said that he didn't touch the candy because he thought they've written a nice note, but it's possible that it's poisoned. Yes, he had to worry about his safety. They have a big guard dog who they live with, and he's moved to a house that's on a private road in order to restrict access to the area where he is. So I think it's a permanent caution. He hasn't had anyone who's actually tried to kill him, but there's a lot of crazy stuff on the Internet, some of it very hostile toward him, and the situation is obviously fragile.
Because, as you say, some people have expressed genuine sympathy, but some blame him for what his son did?
Some do blame him for it. I mean, since the article came out, I've had more than 2,000 emails from people who've written to me in connection with it. I would say 90% of them, at least 80%, say how sorry people are and what an amazing person he sounds like, and, oh, my goodness, I never thought of his suffering. But I would say a good chunk of them, as in the remainder, are from people who are writing in a kind of crazed, that guy should be put behind bars, it's totally his fault, he should be executed. I mean, really angry, hostile stuff, which is quite scary to see, and a certain amount of very angry, hostile stuff targeted at me.
At you as well, for writing with sympathy?
For writing with sympathy, and for... I mean, some of it is from people who believe that the whole thing never happened, that it was put together as a hoax, that I'm somehow working to say that Adam Lanza should have been on medication because I'm shilling for the pharmaceutical industry and taking away the freedom of our children to live unmedicated. There's a lot of craziness out there, and this is the kind of story around which it coalesces.
Some people also have seen it as an anti-Second Amendment news story.
Right.
A hoax to take letters. People's guns away from them.
Exactly. Peter had had letters about that, and I've now had letters about that, too. The whole thing never happened. The children are still alive. It's all a big hoax, and it was set up by left-wing extremists to spearhead gun control legislation and take away those rights.
On the other hand, some people who read your article were horrified that he told you he wished Adam had never been born.
Yes, and I think that was a very, very painful thing for him to tell. And what I ultimately felt was that he was, on the one hand, very much loves still Adam, and on the other hand, recognizes the scale of horror that he achieved. And he said, there's no way I can think about the little boy with whom I had such happy times out of the context of who he became. This is who he ultimately was, and I have to face up to it. So it was a very pained thing, but he said, given the horror of what happened, I can't think anything else. I can only wish he was never born.
You said that some people have judged him harshly. What about Nancy, Adam Lanza's mother?
People judge Nancy much more harshly because Adam lived with her, and even though she was the first victim, they feel that she should have known. But, you know, if she had had any inkling that there was a possibility that he would use guns in that destructive way, she wouldn't have kept them in the house. She never talked about being afraid. She never said it to Peter. She never said it to anyone else. So I think Nancy didn't know. We can say that mothers should know, but as I said at the top of the program, most mothers don't actually know everything about their children. Many mothers don't know incredibly central and crucial things about their children. But the blame on Nancy has been an ongoing theme.
Well, isn't the fact that she kept guns and also shot them with him, isn't that one of the reasons people see this this anti-gun conspiracy in this story? Because it would be pretty easy to blame her for engaging him in a culture of guns.
Well, I think that the fact that people in this country keep guns in their houses is troubling altogether, and I'm afraid I would like to take away people's Second Amendment rights. That's my own personal opinion. But if we accept that it's acceptable to have guns in the house, which seems to be what most of America has accepted, then we have to accept that it was reasonable for Nancy Lanza to keep guns in her house, because Adam had never done anything dangerous. He never spoke about a wish to hurt anyone. He never mentioned shooting another person. And she quite reasonably believed, therefore, that if he was interested in guns in the way that many people with autism are interested in technology of various kinds, that it was reasonable to engage with him on that topic.
What about Adam's older brother, Ryan? Does Peter say anything about Ryan's response to the massacre? Has Ryan spoken out at all about it?
Ryan has not been interested in speaking out about it, and Peter was eager to protect his privacy. But of course, he described how horrifying the whole thing has been for Ryan and how much pain it's affected.
Adam Lanza was 20 years old at the time of the shootings. He's an adult. If people believed that he might be a danger to others, what legally could have been done to prevent him from doing anything?
You know, that's a very complicated question, and I've had a number of letters from people who've written to me and said, I'm concerned that my child might go in that same direction. I might have an Adam Lanza-like child, and I don't know what to do. When children are under 18, of course, parents have considerable control. When they get older, there's much less control. If you genuinely think someone poses an immediate danger, you can notify the police, and the person can be subject to an involuntary psychiatric commitment for a diagnosis or for study to see what's going on. You can try to press someone on to seek therapy and to do the various things that will repair their condition, but people who are getting ready to murder large groups of children are not, by and large, interested in going into a psychiatrist's office and chatting about it. So there really is not a great deal that one can do. One can only provide options. One can say you should take medication. One can set up a doctor's appointment. And one can notify the police if there's the sense someone is truly dangerous.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. His article, The Reckoning, The Father of the Sandy Hook Killer, Searches for Answers, is in the March 17th issue of The New Yorker. When did Peter and Nancy Lanza divorce?
They separated in, I think it was 2001, and they divorced in 2009, I think. I'm not looking at the dates in front of me, but anyway, they were separated for a long time before the divorce actually went through.
And children, even if they are not Asperger's or have other problems, are often very upset when their parents divorce. Do we have any sense of the impact it had on Adam?
Well, Adam, when later asked by a therapist what he made of his parents' divorce, said, they were as irritating to each other as they were to me. The appearance is that Peter, through Adam's childhood, worked very long hours and essentially was around only on the weekends. After the separation, Peter continued to work very long hours. Nancy was with the kids during the week, and Peter tended to take them for a large part of the weekends. So the amount of time they were spending with each parent didn't change enormously. But there's no question that divorce is always traumatic for children, and I think we'll never know what effect it had on Adam's inner life.
Well, Peter gave Adam a birthday card promising to take him hiking or shooting. So that was a part of Adam's life with both parents, wasn't it?
It was primarily with his mother. That birthday card does exist. They didn't actually go shooting in the wake of that, and I don't have information on whether there were other episodes at shooting ranges, but Nancy was the one who was mostly interested in guns.
Officials have released material, including a family photo that shows Adam as a toddler holding a handgun to his mouth and the way that toddlers put things in their mouths. He's dressed in camouflage with an ammunition belt across his lap. Seem to be at least two other guns in the background. Have you seen that photo?
I've seen the photo, but Peter said that it's not a photo of Adam.
It's not a photo of Adam at all?
No.
Oh.
I mean, he said that they had guns in the house, they were interested in guns, Adam had exposure to guns and had toy guns, but he said that photo is not a photo of Adam.
When did Peter Lanza last see Adam before the attack on the school?
2 years before. Peter had said to Adam that he wanted to help him with his college work because Adam struggled with the structures of academics and the process of learning. And he had said to Adam, you really can't take a full course load. Start off with two classes and I'll help you with them. And Adam got very, very angry. Peter said, I almost never saw him that angry, but I saw him that angry on that occasion. And he said to me, I'm taking five classes. I'm taking them. And Peter thought they'd had a relatively minor argument, and he left. And Adam then put off their next couple of meetings and then told Nancy he never wanted to see his father again. And in the 2 years that followed, Peter wrote him letters, Peter sent him emails, Peter called and left him messages. He did all kinds of things in an attempt to reconnect with Adam. But Adam didn't want to see him, and Adam was over 18, and Peter felt he couldn't force the meeting. He said he had separated from his own parents in adolescence, and he therefore thought this was not so strange and abnormal, and he always assumed that he would see Adam again and that it was only a question of when.
In Far From the Tree, you wrote, I'm quoting, "There is no such thing as reproduction. It's often ourselves that we would like to see live forever when we have children, not someone with a personality of his own. Parenthood abruptly catapults us into a permanent relationship with a stranger." So what then can parents do, or what should they do?
Well, I think the first thing is to recognize that your child is in some ways a stranger. It's not to be convinced that you actually know all of what's going on inside your child's life. I think being attentive and vigilant about your child's disturbances is important. I think, as I understand now in a way I didn't before I wrote this article, I think recognizing that a single diagnosis may not explain all of the behavior you're seeing in your child is important, especially with mental health diagnoses. They're constructed. It's not as though they correspond to a specific biology. They're constructed, and they're deeply flawed. So I think all of that is terribly important. And I think trying to encourage someone to communicate, but for people who have got the kind of autism that Adam had, communication is very difficult. I think his parents tried. I really think they do, and I wish I had come away from this saying, now I know what we need to do as a society. If we do X, Y, and Z, this will never happen again. I came away from this thinking it could happen tomorrow, it could happen next week, and I thought my own children, who seem to me the most delightful creatures on the face of the earth, they too could someday be drawn into this. It could happen to me.
Well, Nancy obviously tried to be as close to him as possible, and as you pointed out, he resented it. He felt smothered. You interviewed the parents of Dylan Klebold for Far From the Tree. He was one of the two boys who committed the massacre at Columbine in 1999. And you said you recognized them as essentially decent people who weren't to blame for their son's transgressions. But aren't, as you also have mentioned, people inclined to place blame? How do we change that?
Well, I think people are inclined to place blame. And I felt as I was working on Far From the Tree that we used to say that people were gay because they had overbearing mothers and passive fathers. And we used to say that people had autism because they had refrigerator mothers who were cold and unemotional with them. And we used to say 200 years ago that people had deformities because their mothers were expressing their lascivious longings through the deformity of their children, and so on and so forth. We've sort of dropped the parental blame game in all of those instances. When we're looking at people who commit crimes, we have a complicated situation because there's no question that there are some people who are pushed toward criminality through severe abuse or neglect. So parents can be implicated. But parents are not necessarily implicated or are not necessarily the source of the crime. And I think that we could have a much more productive conversation if we didn't stigmatize these parents so much. I think, however, that if we did that, we would have to admit that this could happen. As Peter said, I want readers of the article to be afraid that this could happen to them. I want everyone to be afraid that this could happen to them. Nobody wants to be afraid in that way. And if we acknowledge that parents don't cause this, if we acknowledge that you can be good parents and still have this happen, then we open up a world of terror to ourselves.
Are these sorts of things more likely to happen in the United States than other countries? I can think of a few instances of kids killing other kids in Britain, but not in other places.
I don't know all of the international statistics, but there's not so much access to guns in most other countries, and so in most European countries in any case. And so this kind of thing doesn't happen so often because people don't have the means to do it. You know, if you're a crazed killer and you go in with a knife, you can't kill as many people as quickly, and someone can knock it out of your hand a lot more readily and a lot faster. And I think that's why they proliferate here. You know, the two big questions around events like this are mental health and guns. We don't have a strong mental health system because of the insurance flaws, Obamacare notwithstanding, many disturbed people don't have access to mental health treatment. We aren't helping the mentally ill in our society. It's different in places like Britain, where nationalized medicine would allow therapy for the people, which was paid for by the state. And we also have these lax gun laws. So between those two things, we're at greater risk for these events.
You mentioned that Adam Lanza's DNA is being sequenced. There's an enormous interest in genetic and neuroscientific explanations for behavior now. Do you think that these new techniques still will fail to help us understand? And we have very little time for you to give me that answer.
I'll just say that I think that brain imaging combined with genetics may ultimately help us to see these disturbances, but I think we're a long way off from knowing how to read that information.
And it's unlikely that we would have brought Adam Lanza in for that kind of imaging before this thing happened, because there was no reason to suspect that he was going to do something like this.
Of course.
Andrew Solomon's article, The Reckoning, The Father of the Sandy Hook Killer Searches for Answers, is in the March 17th issue of The New Yorker. And Andrew, as always, it's been fascinating talking with you. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Such a pleasure for me. Thank you.